meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a live performance by Antonio Rey on Thursday, March 7th, from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall in Portland. Antonio Rey is one of the leading flamenco guitarists of Spain today. Rey will be with flamenco dancer and singer Mara Rey. Again, that's Antonio Rey on Thursday, March 7th from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall, 1422 Southwest 11th in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is David Barsamian of Alternative Radio, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
The Heather McCoy Show.
Welcome to The Heather McCoy Show. Joining me for the full hour is best-selling author Johan Hurry. His new book is called Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions. The book has gotten praise from Hillary Clinton, Tucker Carlson, Russell Brand, Glenn Greenwald, all of whom don't agree on things very often. Johan will be appearing downtown in Powell's, at Powell's Bookstore for an in-store appearance on Friday. I believe that starts at 7:30. Welcome to the show, Johan.
I'm so happy to be with you, Heather. And please don't judge me by Tucker Carlson.
Yeah. As you state in your book, one in five adults in the U.S. are taking at least one antidepressant. You were one of them for a number of years, but not everyone decides to write a book like this. What was your first inkling that this was something that you wanted to write about?
Yeah, if everyone taking antidepressants wrote a book about it, we'd have a massive flood of the book market. There were these two mysteries that were really hanging over me for the longest time. And to be honest, I was quite frightened to look into them. The first mystery is I'm 40 years old. And every year that I've been alive, depression and anxiety have increased here in the United States and across the Western world. And I wanted to understand why. Why is this happening to us? Why are so many people around us finding it harder and harder to get through the day? And this is, you know, manifesting in all sorts of ways. We've just seen, on the day that you and I are speaking, the Center for Disease Control has released figures that show suicide is at the highest level since records began, and that doesn't even include the opioid crisis, which is itself a response to despair. So firstly, it was what's happening to us, and I wanted to understand that, as you allude to, for a very personal reason. You know, when I was a teenager, I remember going to my doctor and saying that I had a feeling like pain was leaking out of me, and I couldn't control it, I couldn't regulate it, I didn't understand why it was happening. And my doctor told me a story that I now realize was really oversimplified. Not that it had no truth, but it was really oversimplified. My doctor said, we know why people feel this way. There's a chemical called serotonin in people's brains. You know, makes them feel good. Some people are naturally lacking it or have a chemical imbalance. You're clearly one of them. All we need to do is give you these drugs, you're going to be fine. So they get. I was given an antidepressant called Paxil, and a really significant boost. And then some months later, this feeling of pain started to come back. So I went back to my doctor. He said, obviously, I didn't get a high enough dose. I was given a higher dose. Again, I felt better. Again, this feeling of pain came back, and I was really in this cycle of taking the maximum possible dose until I was taking the maximum possible dose for 13 years, at the end of which I was still depressed. And I wanted to understand what's going on here. And I was beginning to think, well, if it was just a problem in people's brains, why would it be rising in so many people around me? And I'm doing everything I'm being told to by the culture around me, by the story we tell about depression, and yet I still feel awful. But what am I meant to do? So for my book, Lost Connections, I ended up going on this really big journey. I ended up traveling over 40,000 miles. I wanted to sit with the leading experts in the world about what causes depression and anxiety and what solves them. And just people with really different perspectives, from an Amish village in Indiana, because the Amish have very low levels of depression, to a city in Brazil that banned advertising to see if that would help people, to a lab in Baltimore that gave people psychedelics to see if that would help. And I learned loads of things, but the core of what I learned is there's scientific evidence for 9 causes of depression and anxiety. 2 of them are indeed in our biology. We can talk about that if you like, but
yeah.
Most of them are not in our biology. Most of them are factors in the way we're living that helps us to understand why it's going up. And once you understand that, that opens up a whole different way of dealing with these problems that should be offered alongside the option of chemical antidepressants.
Why does pain seem to always have a narrative? It's not so much the narrative the doctor tells you is that your serotonin levels are different, but then there's this backstory that you tell yourself.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way of putting it. When you're in terrible pain, particularly a really acute depression, it feels like it has no causes, right? It feels like it's just this thing out of the blue. But actually, if you look at the causes of depression and anxiety that I learned about from the leading scientists in the world, there's things that connect a lot of them, not all of them. For example, everyone listening to your show knows they have natural physical needs, obviously, right? You need food, you need water, you need shelter, you need clean air. If I took those things away from you, you'd be in real trouble real fast. But there's equally strong evidence that all human beings have natural psychological needs. You need to feel you belong. You need to feel your life has meaning and purpose. You need to feel that people see you and value you. You need to feel you've got a future that makes sense. And this culture we've built is good at lots of things. I'm glad to be alive today. I had to go to the dentist the other day. I'm glad to be alive in 2019. But we've been getting less and less good at meeting these deep underlying psychological needs. And this is one of the key reasons why we're feeling this way. There are real biological factors that contribute to depression and anxiety. Your genes can make you more sensitive to these problems, just like some people like me find it easier to put on weight and some people who I hate find it really hard to put on weight. There are also real brain changes that happen when you become depressed that make it harder to get out. But most of the things that are going on in driving depression and anxiety for most people are not that. They're these factors related to the way we live.
So if we role play for a second and I'm the patient and you're the doctor and then I come to you and I say I'm depressed, what will the typical interaction be within the Western medicine as it's currently practiced?
Well, I want to stress before I answer that, there are lots of doctors who are dissatisfied with this model and want to do better. And it's not the fault of the individual doctors, but on average, you'll get 6 minutes with your doctor. Your doctor will have the doctor will have very little time to ask you any questions. And almost all, if you go in being depressed, you'll be offered a chemical antidepressant as the first and primary response. Now, I'm not against chemical antidepressants. They have some positive role to play. But there's someone who really helped me to think about this differently. I can talk more about the science, about what antidepressants actually do if you want, and the evidence they have a real effect, but it's actually for most people quite small, and most people taking chemical antidepressants, unfortunately, the long-term research shows, do become depressed again. But there's someone who really transformed how I thought about this. I went to go and see this South African psychiatrist called Derek Summerfield, who happened to be in Cambodia in 2001 when they introduced for the first time chemical antidepressants in that country. And the local doctors, the Cambodians, had never heard of these drugs. So they were like, what are they? And he explained. And they said to him, oh, we don't need them. We already have antidepressants. And he was like, what do you mean? He thought they were going to talk about some kind of herbal remedy like St. John's wort or something. Instead, they told him a story. there was a farmer in that community who worked in the rice fields. And one day he got his leg blown off by a landmine left over from the war with the United States. So they gave him an artificial leg, and he goes back to work in the rice fields. But apparently it's super painful to work underwater when you've got an artificial leg. I'm guessing it was pretty traumatic for obvious reasons. The guy starts to cry all day, doesn't want to get out of bed. He develops classical depression. That's when the Cambodian doctor said to Dr. Somerville, well, that's when we gave him an antidepressant. And he said, what was it? They explained that they went and sat with him. They listened to him. They realized that his pain made sense. It had causes in his life. They figured if they bought him a cow, he could become a dairy farmer. He wouldn't be in this position that was screwing him up. So they bought him a cow. Within a couple of weeks, his crying stopped. Within a month, his depression was gone. They said to Dr. Somerville, so you see, doctor, that cow, that was an antidepressant. That's what you mean, right? Now, if he'd been raised to think about depression and anxiety the way we have, that sounds like a joke. I went to my doctor for an antidepressant. She gave me a cow. But what those Cambodian doctors knew intuitively is what the leading medical body in the world, the World Health Organization, has been trying to tell us for years. If you're depressed, if you're anxious, you're not weak, you're not crazy, you're not a machine with broken parts, you're a human being with unmet needs. And what you need is love and practical help to get those deeper needs met. So a big part of what I'm asking in my book, Lost Connections, is, okay, what's the cow for the things that are screwing us up, right?
So tell us the story behind serotonin and how it became more of a marketing tool than actual science.
So this was one of the things. There are lots of things I learned in the research for the book that were really challenging to me. And I found this really challenging. I want to preface it by saying this doesn't mean there is no value in chemical antidepressants, and it doesn't mean people listening to this show should just stop them. I want to just explain there. It was quite shocking to discover that the story I was told by my doctor, that depression is caused by low serotonin in the brain, there's no scientific evidence for that. The leading expert at Princeton, Professor Andrew Scull, says it is, these are his words, deeply misleading and unscientific to say depression is caused by low serotonin. And one of the leading experts in Europe, Dr. David Healy, said to me, you can't even say that story has been discredited because it was never credited. And there was never a time when half of the scientists in the field thought that. So as you allude to, Heather, how do we end up getting told that story? That was the story the drug company PRs figured out would be the best way to market these drugs, right? Because it makes it sound like you've just got a deficit in your brain, so all you need is that thing that's missing in the brain to be boosted up. And we know how much these drugs work, and they do have some real effect. So depression is generally measured by something called the Hamilton scale. I've always felt really sorry for whoever Hamilton was, that we only remember him by how miserable we all are. But anyway, to give you a sense of the Hamilton scale, it goes from 1, where you would be dancing around in ecstasy, maybe on ecstasy, to 51, where you would be acutely suicidal. And to give you a sense of movement on the Hamilton scale, on average, if you improve your sleep patterns, you will gain 6 points on the Hamilton scale. And if your sleep patterns deteriorate, like when you have a baby, on average, you'll move 6 points the other way. So the leading expert at Harvard Medical School looked at all the data about chemical antidepressants, how far do they move us on the Hamilton scale. What he found is, on average, over time, chemical antidepressants move people 1.8 points on the Hamilton scale. So it's less than a third of improving your sleep patterns. It's important to say that's an average. So I initially got more. Over time, I got less. Also important to say 1.8 points ain't nothing, right? If you're acutely suicidal, that might be the thing that gets you down off the bridge. But it also tells us something else that we've just got to be honest about. For most of us, it's giving a bit of relief. It's not solving the problem. We can see that because for the last 40 years, every year we've increased chemical antidepressant prescriptions, and every year depression, anxiety, and suicide have continued to go up. Now, it's not because of the antidepressants. They are taking the edge off. But there's something missing in that story. What's missing in that story is what's actually causing depression and anxiety. So can I give you a concrete example? Because this can sound a bit kind of overwhelming or fancy.
Yeah, go for it.
We are the loneliest. Yeah. So we are the loneliest society there has ever been. There's a study that asks Americans, how many close friends do you have who you could turn to in a crisis? And when they started doing it years ago, the most common answer was 5. Today, the most common answer is none. There are more Americans who have nobody to turn to when things go wrong than any other option. Half of all Americans asked how many people know you well say nobody. And I spent a lot of time with an amazing man called Professor John Cacioppo, who was at the University of Chicago. Sadly, just died, actually. He was the leading expert on loneliness in the world. And he said to me, you know, why do we exist? You, me, everyone listening to this radio show. One key reason is that our ancestors on the savannas of Africa were really good at one thing. They weren't faster than the animals they took down. They weren't bigger than the animals they took down. But they were much better at banding together into tribes and cooperating. Just like bees live in a hive, humans evolved to live in a tribe. And if you think about the circumstances where we evolved, if you got separated from the tribe, if you were lonely, you know, you were depressed and anxious for a really good reason. You were in terrible danger, right? Those are the impulses we still have. We are the first humans ever to try to disband our tribes, right? And it's making us feel awful. Now, that is one example of many that I go through in the book of a very clear, and one that everyone listening to this intuitively knows is true, and there's a lot of science to back it up, cause in our environment. And there are things we can do about that, right? And I can talk to you about that if you like.
Oh, absolutely. If you're just joining us here on the Heather McCoy Show, our guest is Johan Curry. He's written a book called Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions. He's going to be doing an in-store event at Powell's Bookstore in downtown, 7:30 on Friday night. So one of the interesting things in your book as well is about, like, what are the effects of SSRIs, where it doesn't help as much as other things can, but the side effects are very real.
For some people, they are, yeah. Like 70% of men who take them, it affected my sexual functioning, and I also gained a huge amount of weight. So, again, I want to stress, for some people, the benefits outweigh the side effects, and for some people, those effects are really significant. But we just need to have a slightly more mature conversation about it. Up to now, my argument is we need to expand our idea of what an antidepressant is. Anything that reduces depression and anxiety should be regarded as an antidepressant. For some people, that will include chemicals, and they should certainly be an option on the menu. But let me give you an example of a different kind of antidepressant. So one of the heroes of my book is an amazing guy called Dr. Sam Everington. He's a doctor in East London, where I'm from, as you can tell from my weird Downton Abbey accent. And Sam's actually a doctor in a poor part of East London, just a general practitioner. And Sam was really uncomfortable because he had loads of patients coming to him with depression and anxiety. And like me, he thinks there is a role to be played by chemical antidepressants, but he could see two things. Firstly, most of the people he was giving them to didn't become depressed again. And most of them were depressed and anxious for perfectly understandable reasons. So let's look at loneliness. That was one thing he was very aware of. So one day, Sam decided to pioneer a different approach that's now being imitated all over the world with incredible results. A woman came to see him called Lisa Cunningham, who I got to know later. Lisa had been shut away in her home with terrible depression and anxiety for 7 years. And Sam said to Lisa, "Don't worry, I'll carry on giving you these drugs. I'm also going to prescribe something else." There was an area behind the doctor's surgery that was just a kind of scrubland, right? Empty scrubland. And Sam said to Lisa, "What I'd like you to do is come and turn out a couple of times a week. I'm going to come too because I've been quite anxious. We're going to meet with a group of other depressed and anxious people, and we'll find something to do together so we won't be lonely." The first time the group met, Lisa was literally physically sick with anxiety. But they start talking and they're like, "Okay, what can we do?" These are inner city East London people. Like me, they don't know anything about gardening. They're like, "Hey, maybe we should learn gardening." So they decide they're going to teach themselves gardening. And they start to watch YouTube. They start to read books. They start to get their fingers in the soil. They start to learn the rhythms of the seasons. There's a lot of research. The exposure to the natural world is a really powerful antidepressant. And something even more powerful starts to happen. They start to form a tribe. They start to care about each other and look after each other. If one of them doesn't show up, everyone goes looking for them. They're like, "Hey, do you need any help? But how are you getting on today?" And the way Lisa put it to me, as the garden began to bloom, we began to bloom. There was a study in Norway of a very similar program that found it was more than twice as effective as chemical antidepressants. I think for an obvious reason, right? It was dealing with some of the reasons why the people in the program felt so bad in the first place. And this is something I saw all over the world, from San Francisco to Sydney to Sao Paulo. The most effective strategies for dealing with depression and anxiety are the ones that deal with the reasons why we feel so bad in the first place. Now, I think that gardening program is an antidepressant, right? It's an extremely, according to the best research, is an extremely powerful antidepressant.
An emerging field within city planning is the connection between the built environment and public health. Cities in the U.S. are opting to add health elements to their required elements within their general plan updates. You spend time with the Amish community, as we were talking about earlier. One of them basically kind of laid out the concept of walkable communities. It was hinted at when Lauren Beachy stated that if we had cars and our church district is going to get scattered across 20 miles, end quote. Has there been studies that correlate the prevalence of suburbs, which are highly car dependent, versus the cities where I can take the max and actually interact with people?
Yes, you're on such an important point. So there's this, animals in zoos go crazy, right? Horses start obsessively swaying. Elephants will grind their tusks down to nothing, or their tusks are bloody stumps, even though their tusks are a great source of pride in the wild. Parrots will rip out their feathers. This phenomenon is called zoocosis. If you deprive animals of their natural habitat, they lose it, right? One thing that is happening with depression, I want to stress it's one thing among many, is we're having a kind of zoocosis. There's a really interesting kind of accidental study. And the state prison in Michigan has one big part of it that looks out over beautiful greenery, and one part of it that just looks out over concrete. And it was random where you ended up in prison, right? There's a study that found the people who looked out over the concrete had much higher levels of all forms of mental illness, right? So we evolved to live, just like, you know, parrots evolved to live in a particular environment, we evolved to live in a particular environment. We have been deprived of that environment, and we know that for lots of reasons. We also know that getting people back into natural environments has a really, and that can literally just be a garden, has a really big effect. There's a big debate about why. So partly it's because of what we've just been talking about, our natural environment. One other reason is that one of the things depression is becoming trapped in your own ego and your thought. I can remember this so well, this kind of your thoughts just rattling around and feeling you get no relief from them. And one of the things that tends to happen in natural environments is that people feel a sense of awe. They feel a sense that they're small and the world is big. And this gives a lot of people, it's one of the things that's going on, it gives people a sense of relief from that being imprisoned in yourself, imprisoned in your own ego.
Dr. Terrell Harris, one of the researchers you cite often in the book, states that, quote, no organism exists without the environment. As you're pointing out in the book, doctors are taught in medical school that there's a biopsychosocial model. They've been taught that for decades. Why has that model been left out, and why is it so easy for us just to go to the pills?
Yeah, so I think it's worth explaining what that means. So pretty much everyone agrees, all the scientists agree, there's three kinds of cause for depression and anxiety. There are biological causes, like your genes, real changes that happen in your brain when you become depressed. There are psychological causes, like how you think about yourself, childhood trauma, a whole range of them. And then there are social causes. We've mentioned a few of them, things like loneliness and being cut off from the natural world. All three are real, and all three play out to some degree in all mental illness, although, of course, it varies from person to person how big each one will be, right? But what we've done, there's very broad consensus among scientists about this thing. It's called the biopsychosocial model. And yet, in practice, almost all people get offered is a biological solution, drugs, and maybe a tiny side dish of a kind of psychological solution, you know, a little bit of therapy, and hardly anyone is offered social solutions. So I think part of the reason why we've I mean, we mentioned some of the reasons. There's, you know, a big vested interest in, think about Lisa, that woman I just mentioned who's in the gardening program. There's a $10 billion industry telling her that her distress is just due to a problem in her brain and all she should do is drug herself. And there's a $0 billion industry in getting her to join a gardening program and make friends. And so it's partly, I don't want to overstate that. I think it's partly that we've been trained not to see some of these causes. So let me give you a specific example. I noticed that lots of the people I know who are depressed and anxious, their depression and anxiety focuses around their work. So I started to think, well, okay, maybe the people I know are unusual. Let's look up the evidence. There was a massive study by Gallup, the opinion poll company, that looked at how Americans feel about their work. What they found is 13% of us, 13%, like our jobs most of the time. 63% of what they called sleep working, you don't like it, you don't hate it, you just kind of get on with it. And 24% of people hate and fear their jobs. I was quite struck by that. That means most people don't like the thing they're doing most of the time, right? I started to think, could that be having some effect on our mental health? So I learned that there's an amazing Australian social scientist called Professor Michael Marmot. He made a breakthrough about this in the 1970s, so I went to interview him. Professor Marmot discovered the key factor, not the only one, but the key factor that makes people depressed at work. If you go to work tomorrow and you have low or no control over your work, you are much more likely to become depressed and anxious. I think that, and I'm going a bit beyond what he says now, but I think that's because of what we were saying before about we all have natural psychological needs. You need to feel your life has meaning, right? And if you're controlled all the time, you can't create meaning out of your work. But at first, I actually misunderstood this evidence. So I thought Professor Marmot was saying, okay, you've got this elite 13% who get to have nice jobs they control, and then you've got everyone else who's condemned to this misery. And I thought about my family, right? My brother is an Uber driver. My dad was a bus driver. My grandmother's job was to clean toilets. I was saying, what, are we saying they're just condemned to be miserable? And he explained to me, it's not the work that makes you depressed. It's being controlled at work. And there's something as a society we can do about that. So I went to Baltimore to interview a woman called Meredith Keough, who used to go to bed every Sunday night just sick with anxiety, right? She worked in an office. As Meredith would tell you, it wasn't the worst office job in the world. She wasn't being bullied or harassed, but it was really monotonous. She had very little control, and she couldn't bear the thought this was going to be the next 40 years of her life. So one day, with her husband Josh, she did this quite bold thing. Josh had worked in bike stores in Baltimore since he was a teenager. And one day, with his colleagues in his bike store, they're just fixing bikes, and one of them said, hey, what does our boss actually do? They quite liked their boss. He wasn't an awful person, but they were like, we seem to fix all the bikes, and he seems to make all the money. I don't know we're getting a good deal out of this. So they decided they were going to set up a bike store of their own that worked on a different principle. Their bike store, so the place where they worked before was a corporation. Most people listening to this show will work in a corporation. You know how it works. It's a very recent human invention. You know how it works. You know, you've got the boss at the top who's like a dictator, and we've all got to obey the dictator, and if you don't, you're out, right? They decided they were going to set up a bike store that works on an older American idea. Their store is a democratic cooperative. They don't have a boss. They run the business together. They take the decisions collectively by voting. They share the profits. They share out the good tasks and the crappy tasks, and no one gets stuck with the crappy tasks. And one of the things that was so striking to me, spending time in their business, totally in line with Professor Marmot's findings, is how many of them talked about being depressed and anxious before and were not depressed and anxious now. And it's not like they quit their job fixing bikes and went off to become like Beyonce's backing singers, right? They fixed bikes before, they fixed bikes now. What's the difference? Now they had control over their work. Now, lots of people listening are going to think, right, I can't do that. And it's true, the way our society is structured, we can't do that. But this is a big change we can make. Everyone listening to your show has lived through big changes. I'm gay. I didn't even hear the concept of gay marriage till I was 40. The women listening to the show don't need me to mansplain this to them, but you know, my grandmothers weren't even allowed to have bank accounts in their own names when they got married. We've all lived through big civilizing changes. We need to give people back control over their work. Most of us spend most of our time working, waking lives. We've got to give people back control. That will significantly reduce depression and anxiety. There's no reason why we should be structuring our society so most of us are spending our time in environments that make us feel depressed and humiliated.
I remember reading a book about work. I don't remember the author, but he started the book by quoting Marx about the nature of work when your labors are not under your control. To my surprise, as a younger person, I was surprised that this disconnection from work hasn't changed from around the 1800s when Marx wrote those words. And then when I was reading in 2001, when I was stuck at a bad job at a grocery store, how do you make those changes if you can't join a co-op? I mean, what changes do we collectively have to make?
I think there's a whole range of them. And the last third of my book, Lost Connections, is really looking at what are the changes we need to make. There are changes people can make as individuals, and I talk about that, and there are big social changes. So let me give you an example of a big social change that led to a really significant effect on mental health. In the 1970s, the Canadian government chose at random a town called Dauphin in Manitoba. It's about 4 hours out of Winnipeg, for people who know Canada. And they said to a huge number of people in this town, we're doing an experiment. From now on, we're going to give all of you a guaranteed income. It was the equivalent of $12,000 a year. They said, there's nothing you can do that means that we'll take this away from you, and you don't have to do anything in return for it. We just want you to have a secure life, right? And this was monitored by scientists, an amazing woman called Dr. Evelyn Forget, and to see what would happen. And loads of things happened, but to me, the most interesting is there was a really significant fall in mental health problems. Mental health problems that were so severe that people had to be shut away in psychiatric hospitals fell by 9%, and in just 3 years. And this fits with something that is in many ways completely common sense, right? Half of all Americans, through no fault of their own, because of these big changes in the economy, have been unable to set aside $500 for if something goes wrong in their lives, right? I mean, think about how insecure and frightening that is. And yet what's happening, we've had a society where people have become much more financially insecure, where the middle class is collapsing, where people are being humiliated, where that causes a huge amount of distress. And then they go to their doctors, and what are they told? They're told, oh, this is just due to a chemical imbalance in your brain. As the World Health Organization tells us, we need to talk much less about chemical imbalances and much more about imbalances in the way we live, right? There are factors in the way we are living that are driving up depression and anxiety. And we can deal with those factors, right? Now, that's obviously another big change we can make, one that's been proven to work. I go through lots of other ones. But we've got to get out of this mentality, this mindset of saying that depression is just a problem in the individual, and it's the job of the isolated, depressed individual to solve it. Now, there are real biological factors playing out in individual depressed people. They are real. There are things that isolated individuals can do, but most of what's going on is not that, right? It's not that people in West Virginia have, by a factor of 20 times, more chemically malfunctioning brains than people in Boston, right? I mean, this is absurd, right? What is happening? And of course, this can happen at any level of the economic scale, but it's concentrated more for people who are at the bottom. So we've got to look at these 9 deeper factors that I write about in Lost Connections, and then look at the scientists I met all over the world who are building solutions around this deeper understanding of what's really going on.
If you're just joining us on the Heather McCoy Show, my guest is Johan Hari. His new book is called Lost Connections, Undiscovering the Real Causes of Depressions and the Unexpected Solutions. He's going to be at an event, 7:30, downtown Powell's Bookstore, if you want to see the in-store appearance. Related to work, due to the inequality that is pervasive in society right now, onset by something that we call neoliberal globalism, has made a major disconnection to the hope to a hopeful or secure future. Can you go into that concept further and how they're intertwined?
Yeah, I think this is really important to understand. One of the people who helped me to understand it is a guy called Professor Robert Sapolsky at Stanford, who spent years studying baboons in Kenya, right? And baboons live in the males, not the women, live in a really strict hierarchy. So let's say if there's 40 men in the the group, the troupe. Number one knows he's above number two. Number two knows he's above number three. Number three knows, and so on and so all the way down the chain, right? And and where you are in the hierarchy determines like what you get, whether you what you get to eat, who you get to have sex with, all of that. And Professor Sapolsky spent years studying two things: when are baboons most stressed, and when do they despair? And turns out, when baboons get pushed to the bottom of this hierarchy, and you move around the hierarchy, often what happens when they're pushed to the bottom of the hierarchy is the baboons will just give up. They'll cover their heads, they'll put their bottoms in the air, it's a kind of way of saying, and they'll just not move. And they'll become really listless, they'll stop eating. It looks a lot like human depression, right? It's basically them saying, okay, you beat me, just leave me alone. So that was one circumstance where they were most stressed. The other circumstance when they were most stressed is when they felt their status was insecure. So even if you were number one, if you felt that other people were circling and going to take away the number one slot, then you were even more depressed than the poor suckers at the bottom, and you showed even more levels of stress and anxiety, right? And I think that your listeners are picking up on the obvious parallel. You know, as a society, one, all of us have more insecure statuses, right? We know about changes that have happened in the economy, or most people have more insecure statuses. Also, more and more of us are feeling that we've been pushed to the bottom of the pile, right? And there's a wonderful group of parasocial scientists, a married couple called Kate Pickett and Richard Wilkinson, who've shown, you know, as a society becomes more unequal, depression and anxiety go up because more people feel that sense of humiliation and insecurity and that they've been pushed to the bottom. So again, universal basic income, which I talked about before, is one of the ways of dealing with that. But there's much bigger, your listeners know, there's much bigger political projects afoot. You can see what's happening in the Democratic primary to deal with this. But I think what we've had up to now is too apolitical an understanding of our pain, right? There are causes of this depression, anxiety that are not directly political. One of the ones I found hardest to learn about was childhood trauma. I hope we get to that. But many, and of course, the things like brain changes are not political. But a lot of these causes are political, and there's really good scientific evidence for this. And I think this should be a much bigger political issue, right?
Discuss how the residents reconnected in the city of Berlin after an elderly woman essentially put up a suicide note on her apartment window after rents were scheduled to go up.
Yeah, you know, from my book I learned so much from so many people, scientists, but I think of all the places I went, these are the people who taught me the most. So in the summer, and these people are not scientists at all, in the summer of 2011, on a big anonymous housing project in Berlin, a Turkish-German woman called Nuria Cengiz climbed out of her wheelchair and put a sign in the window of her apartment. She lived on the ground floor, and the notice said something like, I got a letter today saying I'm going to be evicted from my apartment next Thursday, so on Wednesday night I'm going to kill myself. And this is a big anonymous housing project, like one in many parts of the United States. It's quite a poor area. No one really knew anyone. There were only three groups of people who really lived in this area. There were recent Muslim immigrants, this woman Nuria, there were gay men, and there were punk squatters. And as you can imagine, these groups didn't get along very well, and no one really knew anyone. But people see this notice outside Nuria's window, and they start to knock on her door, and they're like, do you need any help? And she said, no, screw you, I don't want any help, I'm going to kill myself. But a few of the people started talking, people we'd never met, started talking outside her apartment. And one of them had an idea. There's a big thoroughfare that goes through this housing project, which is called Kotti, that goes into the center of Berlin. And one of them said, you know, if we just blocked the road for a day, and we all protested, and they were all annoyed that their rents were going up, everyone's rent was going up, lots of people were being evicted. We block the road for a day and we protest about the rents, they'll probably let Nuria stay. There might even be some pressure to keep rents down for all of us. Why don't we do it? So they decided to do it. Saturday comes, they block the road. Nuria was like, I'm going to kill myself, I may as well let them push me into the middle of the street. She sits there, they do a load of interviews. It's a little bit of a media, you know, a little bit of a media storm that day in Berlin. And then it gets to the end of the day, and the police are like, okay, you had your fun, take it down. But the people who live at Kotti were like, well, hang on a minute. You haven't told Nuria she gets to stay. Actually, we want a rent freeze for our entire housing project. When we get that, then we'll take it down. But of course, they knew the minute they left this barricade, the police would just tear it down anyway. So one of my favorite people in Kotti, one of the punk squatters, she's called Tanya Gartner. Tanya wears tiny little miniskirts, even in Berlin winter, and she's quite hardcore. Tanya went up to her apartment, where she had a klaxon, you know, those things that make loud noises at soccer matches. She brings it down, and she's like, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to drop a timetable to man this barricade 24 hours a day until we get what we want. If the police come to take it down, let off this klaxon and we'll all come down from our apartments and we'll stop them. So people start signing up to man this barricade, right? Ends up being pretty unlikely pairings. So, for example, Tanya in her tiny miniskirt was paired with Nuria, the woman who'd put up this note, who's a very religious Muslim wearing a full hijab. At first, they sit there a lot. They're like, we've got nothing to talk about. This is so awkward. This is so awful. They look away from each other. As the nights go on, awkwardly, they start to talk. After a few weeks, they discovered they had something incredibly powerful in common. Nuria had come to Berlin when she was 16 from her village in Turkey with her two young children, and she was meant to raise enough money to send back home for her husband to join her. But after she had been in Berlin for 18 months, she got word from home that her husband had died. She told Tanya, sitting there in the cold in Kotti, something she'd never told anyone in Germany. She'd always told people that her husband had died of a heart attack. Actually, he had died of tuberculosis, which was seen as a kind of shameful disease of poverty. That's when Tanya told Nuria something she rarely talked about. She had come to Kotti when she was 15. She'd been thrown out by her middle-class family. She'd found her way to live in a punk squat in Kotti. And not long after she arrived there, she got pregnant. They realized they had both been children with children of their own in this place they didn't really understand. And directly opposite this housing project, there's a gay club called Zudblock, run by a man I love called Richard Stein, who is quite a hardcore. I mean, to give you a sense of what this gay club is like, the previous place Richard owned was called Cafe I thought you wouldn't want to have a sandwich from Cafe A. And when this gay club had opened, you know, this is an area with a lot of religious Muslims. As you can imagine, there was a lot of resistance. Their windows had even been smashed. When the protest began, this gay club gave all their furniture to the barricade. They started giving them free drink and food. After a while, the people at this gay club, Zudblock, were like, well, you should have all your meetings in our club. We'll give you, you know, drink and food and everything. And even the left-wingers at Kotti were like, we're not going to get these very religious Muslims to come and have meetings in a gay club, quite hardcore gay club. It's not going to happen. It did start to happen. I remember one of the Turkish-German women there, Neriman, telling me, we all realized we had to take these small steps to understand each other. After the protest had been going on for nearly a year, one day a guy arrived at the protest called Tunkai. He was in his early 50s and he'd been clearly living homeless. And when you meet Tunkai, it's clear he's got some kind of cognitive challenges, some kind of cognitive difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
But he's got an amazing energy about him. He's a lovely person. And quite quickly, everyone liked him. And by this time, the barricade they had built in the middle of the street was literally a permanent structure with a roof, right? And they were like, we don't want you to be homeless. You should come and live in this thing we've built. So Tunkai came to live there and he became a much-loved part of the protest. And after he'd been there for 9 months, one day the police came to inspect. They would do this every now and then. And Tunkai doesn't like it if people are arguing. He thought they were arguing, the police. So he went to try to hug one of the police officers, but they thought he was attacking them, so they arrested him. That was when it was discovered. Tunkai had been shut away in a psychiatric hospital, often literally in a padded cell, for 20 years. He'd escaped one day, he lived on the streets for a few months and he found his way to Kotti. So the police took him back to this psychiatric hospital, at which point the entire Kotti protest movement turned itself into a free Tunkai movement, right? They descend on this psychiatric hospital at the other side of Berlin. And these psychiatrists are like, what is this? They've got all these very camp gay men, these women in hijabs, and these punks demanding the release of this person they've had shut away for 20 years. But I remember Uli Hartmann, one of the protesters, said to them, yeah, but you don't love him. He doesn't belong with you. We love him. He belongs with us. Many things happened at Koti. They got Tunkai back. It took a while. He lives there still. They got a rent freeze for their entire housing project. They then launched a referendum initiative to keep rents down across the whole city, which got the largest number of written signatures in the history of the city of Berlin. But the last time I saw Nuria, she said to me, the woman who started it all, she said to me, you know, I'm really glad I got to stay in my apartment. That's great. I gained so much more than that. I was surrounded by these incredible people all along, and I would never have known. And then one of the other Turkish German women there, Meriman Manker, said to me, you know, when I grew up in Turkey, I grew up in a village, and I called my whole village home. And then I came to live in the Western world, and I learned that what we're meant to call home here is just our four walls. And she said, then this whole protest began, and she started to call this whole place and all these people her home. And she said she realized, in some sense, in this culture, we are homeless. The Bosnian writer, Alexander Heyman, said, home is where people notice when you're not there. By that standard, a lot of us have a very small or no sense of home. And it was so clear to me in Koti, so many of these things that I had been taught about depression and anxiety by scientists. You know, I think about how distressed these people were. Nuria was about to kill herself. Tunkai was shut away in a padded cell. Loads of these people were depressed and anxious. In the main, they did not need to be drugged. They needed to be together. They needed to be seen and valued and loved and to have something meaningful to do in their lives. And I remember one time sitting with Tanya outside Ziblock, this gay club, and her saying to me, you know, when you feel like crap and you're all alone, you think there's something wrong with you. But what we did is we came out of our corner crying and we started to fight. And we realized we were surrounded by people who feel the same way. And it was so revelatory to me because, you know, I think you can tell I love these people. I think they're amazing. But in one sense, they are entirely ordinary, right? These are randomly selected people. This hunger for reconnection is just beneath the surface. We can all feel, including people who are not depressed and anxious or addicted, can feel something's not right with this culture we built. There's lots of good things about it, to be sure. But something's not right here, right? This is why these indicators of depression, suicide, addiction, and despair are rising so much. We've built a culture that a lot of us is not meeting some of our most basic psychological needs. And the thing that will heal that is a project of reconnection. Now, that's reconnection across many different factors and many different ways.
Well, Koti is a hopeful model for building community while addressing the major issue of affordable housing. I often feel despair over the fact that kids are being held in cages by ICE, and well, the mainstream conversations are still centered around consumer products and the newest comic book movie.
Yeah.
Things are that bad, but the magnetic energy that seemed to happen in Koti seems rare, or am I wrong?
It's rare in the culture we built. It was the norm for human beings,
yeah,
until quite recently, right? I mean, living in tribes, looking out for everyone in the tribe. That's why we exist, because we're a species that did that. For it's not going to be overly romantic about it. There were a lot of problems in the past. It's not about going back to some magical past. But, you know, it's interesting. I thought a lot about what you said, right?
Yeah.
That feeling of pessimism about what's happening all around us, which obviously I share. I remember being in Cleveland in the run-up to the 2016 election. We were trying to get out the vote to stop Trump. I'm sure your listeners have already guessed my politics. And we were on this street where a third of the houses were abandoned, a third had actually been demolished, and a third still had people living in them. And there was this one house, I was with a guy called Dave Fleischer, who works for the LA LGBT Center, he's a wonderful person. And we knock on this door, and there's a woman I would have guessed from looking at her was 60. We get talking, she was actually 37. and we're talking. She was quite articulate. She knew a lot. Extremely angry. She was not going to vote for Hillary Clinton. And she made this verbal mistake that's really stayed with me. She was talking about what the area used to be like for her parents and grandparents, and how when they left school at 16, they got good jobs and had a kind of middle-class life. And she meant to say, when I was young. What she actually said is, when I was alive. And she didn't notice she'd done it. And it really haunted me, and it's really fixed as my memory of the election, right? Now, you don't want to overstate this. Trump voters are, on average, slightly wealthier than non-Trump voters. But, and so I share that feeling of revulsion and that feeling that this is coming from a deep sadness and sickness in our culture. You know, the Bengali writer Krishnamurti said, it's no sign of good health to be well-adjusted to a sick society. But when I feel those feelings of deep pessimism, I remember something. And so I think about every day, actually. So one of my closest friends is a writer called Andrew Sullivan. Lots of your listeners will know his work. He's a journalist. In 1993, Andrew was diagnosed as HIV positive. It's the height of the AIDS crisis. His best friend had just died of AIDS. There was no hope in sight. And Andrew leaves his job, and he goes to a little town in Cape Cod called Provincetown to die. And he decides he's going to do one last thing before he dies. He's going to write a book about a crazy utopian idea. He's like, okay, I'll obviously never live to see this happen. No one alive now will live to see this happen. But maybe someone way down the line will pick up this idea. The idea that he wrote the first book ever advocating was gay marriage. And when I get depressed, I try to imagine going back in time to 1993 and saying to Andrew, okay, Andrew, you're not going to believe me. 26 years from now, A, you're going to be alive. You wouldn't believe that. B, you'll be married to a man. That'll be a thing. C, I'll be with you when the Supreme Court of the United States quits this book you're writing now in a ruling making it mandatory for every state in the United States to introduce gay marriage. And the next day, you're going to be invited to a White House that will be lit up in the colors of the rainbow flag to have dinner with the president to celebrate what you and so many other people have achieved. Oh, and by the way, that president, he's going to be black, right? Every aspect of that story would have sounded ridiculous, right? It would sound like crazy science fiction. It happened. Andrew's alive. He lived to see it all. It happened not because there's any law of nature that makes things get better. The only thing Martin Luther King ever said that I don't agree with is that thing about the arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. It doesn't naturally bend towards justice, but we can bend it towards justice, right? So, and one of the good things about the situation we're in, I don't think there's that many, but one of them is when the house is on fire and every alarm is going off, then the case for radical change becomes easier to make, right? It's easier to say we need to change the house when the house is on fire than when the house is lovely and beautiful and everyone likes it, right? And the indicators of distress are so acute. More people died in the opioid crisis last year than all the American soldiers who died in the Vietnam War combined.
Whoa.
When that many people are finding it so intolerable to be present in their lives that they're anesthetizing themselves to the point of death, that tells us something about what's going on in the culture. You know, and that should, in one sense, tragic and horrific as it is, means the case for these deep changes becomes harder and harder to deny. Doesn't mean the forces we're up against will just give up, but it does mean more and more people can be persuaded of the kind of case that we're making and can be encouraged to join us, to fight with us. Because if you think about the nine factors that cause depression and anxiety that I write about in my book, Lost Connections, some people, it makes them acutely depressed. But almost everyone in this culture is made less happy than they could be by these factors, by acute loneliness. There's a whole range of them that I go through in the book. And healing these things won't just deal with depression and anxiety, and won't just, I think, deal with some of the political extremism that you and I are both horrified by. It will make almost everyone's life better.
On Christmas Day in 2016, Amy Kutkin a blogger for the feminist website, Jezebel.com, posted an article entitled, "When Can I Say I'll Be Alone Forever?" She states that she has a job she loves, a stable income, and has a healthy social life. But at the time she wrote it, she hadn't had a date in forever and also hasn't had sex in 3 years. The situation was clearly causing her depression, and her social circle was also telling her that, don't worry about it, you'll find somebody, which compounded her pain. This is an issue for me as well. Is this perhaps the next logical step, a sequel, if you will, for your current book, Lost Connections?
I haven't thought enough about that specific area. So there's been a decline in... One of the things that has been a huge decline in teenagers having sex, which in some ways is good. It's obviously got a decline in teenage pregnancies and things, but actually I think it's kind of a sad signal. And I think partly, I haven't read that article, I remember hearing about it at the time, I think part of the problem is a kind of Tinderization of the culture, right? Which is like, okay, it's your job to entertain me for 5 minutes, and if you fail that audition, you're out, right? It means very tenuous connections and the impression of lots of choice. But the choices available are all these shallow connections, right? I want to think about the relationship between the internet and depression and anxiety. So I went to the first ever internet rehab center in the world. It's in Spokane in Washington State, just outside Spokane. It's it's really interesting. So they get a huge range of people in this internet rehab center, but they disproportionately get young men who've become addicted to multiplayer role player games like World of Warcraft, or now it would be Fortnite, and porn, online porn. And I remember Dr. Hillary Cash, the woman who runs the Restart Washington, saying to me, you've got to ask yourself, what are these young men getting out of these games and this porn? Actually, they're getting the things they used to get from the culture, but they no longer get when we think about the games. They're getting a sense that they're good at something. They're getting a sense that they can roam around. They hardly ever leave their homes. If you look at the figures for kids playing outdoors, it's extraordinary. They get a sense of a tribe, right? They're playing with their friends. But what they're getting, and this is me saying this now, not Dr. Cash, I think is a kind of parody of those things. I think the relationship between social media and social life is a bit like the relationship between porn and sex. I'm not against porn, but if your entire sex life consisted of looking at porn, you'd be going around pissed off and irritated the whole time because we didn't evolve to, you know, just look at screens. We evolved to actually have sex. And in a similar way, we didn't evolve to, you know, scream abuse at each other through screens. We evolved to look into people's eyes, to be seen, to be heard. I mean, it's slightly more complicated because, of course, the internet, when does the internet arrive? For most of it arrives in the late 90s, the early 2000s, when actually a lot of the factors that cause depression and anxiety that I write about in Lost Connections were already supercharged, right? There's already a big increase in loneliness, in loss of status at work, that kind of thing. And what happens is the internet arrives and it looks a lot like the things we've lost. You've lost friends. Here's some Facebook friends. You've lost status. Here's some status updates. But it's not the thing we've lost. It's a kind of parody of the thing we've lost. And I think this difficulty of people finding partners is partly, which is a rising phenomenon, I think is partly, like I say, this kind of Tinder effect. I don't want to single out Tinder. It's not worse than there are others. But this Tinder effect, which is like you can just eternally swipe right on people and you can eternally, you know, dismiss people. And live in this world of tenuous, shallow connections, which makes you feel anxious and depressed. And then you go to a doctor and you're told it was just a problem in your brain. Not all doctors, of course, some are more sophisticated than that. So I do think that's part of what's going on. Does that make sense to you, Heather?
Oh, that absolutely makes sense. Because it was weird. So like when I was buying a car, I was going to the basically autotrader.com, and then my friends were like, oh, you need to go to an OKCupid, and it's almost the exact same interface.
That's so interesting, right? Exactly. That. Well, I think that goes to one of the other causes of depression and anxiety that I write about in the book, which I think is really interesting, which is that we all know that junk food has taken over our diets and made us physically sick, but there's equally strong evidence that a kind of junk values have taken over our minds and made us mentally sick. It's just discovered by an amazing man called Professor Tim Kasser, who showed the more you think life is about money and status and showing off, the more likely you are to become depressed and anxious. I think because this doesn't meet our deeper needs as human beings. He also showed, as a society, as a culture, we have become much more driven by these junk values, right? So I think you're right that if you start to see your human relationships as, you know, like buying things, which is how, I mean, an extreme example is Melania Trump, who years ago when she went to speak at NYU was asked, would you have married Donald Trump if he wasn't rich? And she said, do you think he would have married me if I wasn't beautiful? Think about what that reveals.
Wow. Right?
It reveals that they know the terms of their relationship. So compare that to a couple who would say, look, I love my partner, whatever happens, if he's poor, if he's rich, if he becomes homeless, if he gets burned at a fire, whatever, I love him. I just love him because of him, right? Compare that. Melania Trump knows, well, if she ever ceased to be beautiful, she'd be out. And Donald Trump knows, if he ever ceased to be rich, he'd be out. You can see how that creates a more tenuous, anxiety-provoking kind of relationship than someone who just values you for you, right? Now, Donald and Melania Trump are a very extreme end of the spectrum, obviously. But we've all become more like the Trumps, right? We may not want to admit it, but we have. The culture has become more like the Trumps. So you can see that, exactly what you're saying. If you view finding someone to share your life with as like a shopping, you know, ordering something on Amazon, and that's going to create a different kind of attitude to that relationship, which is going to be more anxiety-provoking and less nourishing for everyone involved.
My guest has been Johan Hari. His new book, Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and Unexpected Solutions, is out now. He's going to be at Powell's Books downtown at Friday night, 7:30. Thanks for joining us on the show today.
Oh, thank you so much. Anyone who wants any more information about where to get the book or the audio book, can go to www.thelostconnections.com. And thank you for reading the book so closely, Heather. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome. And this is the Heather McCoy Show.
That was the Heather McCoy Show on KBOO Portland. Now we will be having an EAS emergency alert test. This is only a test. After, we will continue with our regular programming.